despite Yizkor, and despite a variety of symbols and rituals, Yom Kippur is not about death. Yom Kippur is about the lessons that death teaches us about life. And the day is filled with such symbols and such rituals. Not just the memorial prayers that we recite, but clothes many of us wear. We're dressed in white, not merely as a symbol of the hope of purity, purity from sin, but as a reminder of the shrouds that we'll one day wear. Fasting has not only the function of enabling us to focus exclusively on how we want to change our lives. Fasting is to bring us as close as possible to death. We don't wear leather shoes, not only because we don't want to affront God when we ask for mercy, and the wearing of leather shoes would show that we weren't merciful for taking the lives of other of God's creatures. But in many communities on Yom Kippur, they remove their shoes as a reminder of what it feels like when one is sitting Shiva. And some very pious people would on Kol Nidre night not sleep on a bed, but on the floor. Because the floor with its boards was symbolic of the bier that upon which they would be carried to their final resting place. Yom Kippur is filled with symbols of death, the purpose of which is to teach us about life. That only when we see how fragile life is, do we begin to appreciate how we are to live it. But whenever I try to take that lesson to heart, I am plagued by what I and you, of course, have learned about the Holocaust. It challenges my theology and my belief in God, and challenges my belief in human beings and the potential for goodness, the power of salvation, of redemption. And still I search for the lessons that death teaches about life, even in those stories. Let me tell you of such a story that took place on the evening of Yom Kippur. I heard it from a survivor, from one of you. We were in the barracks in Auschwitz, he said, when all of a sudden, one of the older prisoners, and older in those days meant 40, who was a very religious man, he remembered that that night was Yom Kippur. He had kept the calculation of the Jewish calendar and revealed to all of us that this was Kol Nidre night. And then he took out two candles. I don't know how he got them or how he made them. I think they were from margarine or something. But he lit the candles and we all gathered around him. And each and every one of us knew at that moment that if the door would open and any Nazi would walk in or any guard or even a couple, we were doomed. For the penalty for commemorating Yom Kippur was instant death. And yet, we gathered around him. And his voice began to lift as he sang the prayers of Yom Kippur. Kol Nidre. And then Unasana Tokef. On Rosh Hashanah it is written, and Yom Kippur is sealed. Who will live and who will die? Who will live out the end of their days and whose days will be cut short? Who will die by plague and who will die by famine? Who will die by water and who will die by fire? And there he stopped. For outside our barracks was the chimney, 70 feet high. And through that chimney, in the fire, were our people, after being gassed, burned in fire. We began to talk. Some of us saw it as an opportunity to deny the existence of God. Others were asking, why? How? How could a God that our people prayed for so many centuries be doing what he is doing now? How could the God of Israel let this happen? How? And we kept talking through a good portion of the night until finally we came to the conclusion that it was not God that was doing this, but people, human beings, men and women too, who had made a choice to live a life of evil, of inflicting pain, suffering, and death upon others. And all the while, there was a sound coming from the outside. As we struggled to find some meaning and some understanding into what was happening to us and to those whom we cherished, we could hear from the outside, click, 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 day and night. It were the trains that were going over the tracks, bringing in our people to Auschwitz, and then leaving to get more. And throughout that Kol Nidre and that Asana Tokef, click, 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 click. And none of us could go to sleep that night. It was afterwards I learned that my 16-year-old sister was burned that day. And she did not even have the benefit of a quick death. Because when her train arrived, the station was so full, they left the Jews and the cattle cars for 3 days standing in the station and then dragged them out and burned them. Miva Mayim umiva Esh, who by water and who by fire. And to this day, I cannot pass through a Kol Nidre without hearing click, 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 click. That's the nightmare of Stefan Einhorn. That was one of his many, many, many stories. a man who spent 4 years in the death camps and survived never knowing why. His story plagued me and made me ask the same question that those men in the barracks asked. How could it have happened? Who was responsible? Where was God? But I took to heart his answer. And that answer was that it was the choice of human beings. It was men and women who chose to do evil. Another story. From an English newspaper from Frankfurt, Germany. It tells the story of an individual who made a different choice. Of an Austrian religious Christian who was conscripted into the German army, into the Wehrmacht, against his will. And because he was older than most of the other soldiers, they sent him to the rear lines, not where the fighting was, in Soviet-occupied and ultimately German-occupied Lithuania. And when the Wehrmacht came into Vilna on the 24th of June, 1941, there were 65,000 Jews herded into the ghetto. Their ordeal began the next day. The SS and police forces began to gather them together, arrest them, put to death the able-bodied Jewish males, murdering them in the forests of Ponari. The killing of Vilna's Jews expanded to include soon the women and the children. And from 65,000 in a very short time, there were 12,000 Jews left in Vilna and 8,000 Jews who had fled into hiding. We've all heard of Oskar Schindler and his efforts to rescue Jews during the Nazi era. But much less is known of a Wehrmacht sergeant named Anton Schmidt, who saved hundreds and hundreds of Jews while in a German uniform, and in particular, assisted in the creation of the Jewish resistance in Lithuania. His entire career of saving Jews went from June 1941 until January 1942, when he was caught by his superiors, arrested, court-martialed, and executed. But in that time, he had managed to save hundreds of Jews during his duty of gathering the stragglers from the German army and bringing them back to their units. And he used the transport of the German military to ferret Jews from Vilna out into the forests, to Belarusia, and to assist Jews who wanted to go to the Warsaw Ghetto to plan that uprising. In Yad Vashem in Israel, there's the testimony of countless resistant fighters who say that this man, this righteous Gentile, deserves a place as great as any other for what he gave his life for. What motivated him was his belief in God. Not that God would take care of everything, but that it was the responsibility of individuals to behave in accordance with divine principles. Before he was executed, the chaplain of the prison came to visit him, and through the chaplain he smuggled out a letter he wrote to his wife. I want to read to you an excerpt from that letter. It was to his wife, Steffi, and to their daughter, Gerda. I am glad, my darlings, that you are healthy and doing all right. Today I can finally tell you everything about the fate approaching me. I have been sentenced to death by court-martial in Vilna, and there is nothing I can do about it. But my darlings, keep your heads up. I have accepted my fate. This was decided by our dear God above. Nothing can be changed. And today I am so calm that I cannot believe it myself. But our dear God must have wanted it this way and made me strong in my last hours. I hope that he makes you as strong as me. I want to tell you how it all happened. There were a great number of Jews here in Vilna. The Lithuanian ministry drove them together, took them out to a forest, and shot them in a meadow outside the city, 2,000 to 3,000 people at a time. They dashed the children against the trees. You can't even imagine it. I just had to do what I must do. They took me to the stragglers' center where 140 Jews worked. They asked me to ferret them away from here. I let them persuade me. I helped them, and the court said I was wrong. Remember, my dear Steffi and Gerda, it is a hard blow for you. And by the time you, my dears, hold this letter in your hand, I will no longer be on this earth. I will not be able to write to you again. But rest assured, we will see each other in a better world, along with our dear God. In 1955, Yad Vashem published a very extensive story of Anton Schmidt. And 9 years ago, the Ministry of Defense for the government of Germany dedicated a school in its military in his memory, naming it the Sergeant Schmidt Barrack Anti-Aircraft School. And in the speech he said, Sergeant Anton Schmidt displayed boldness, valor, and courage. And in naming this facility in his honor, we bow before the achievements of a man who spontaneously and of his own accord knew what to do to save countless peoples from certain death, and sadly paid for his actions with his own life at our hands. Tell the story of Sergeant Anton Schmidt again and again, he said, so that the times in which he had to live and the time in which he had to die will never be repeated. They were both Germans, Austrians, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, in uniform. Some made the choice to shoot. Others made the choice to save. Even the Holocaust teaches us about life. That wherever we are, we have a choice. The choice between right and wrong, between good and evil. We can live our lives going from day to day filled with anger, resentment, hatred, strife. Or we can leave those pekulak behind us and fill our lives with the jewels of love, of kindness, of forgiveness, of compassion. It is our choice. And death teaches us that we do not have an infinite amount of time to make these choices. We must make them every day. I want to shift my remarks to a different topic. Because just as I remember the Holocaust, I also remember another event that took place on Yom Kippur. And that was the day in which Israel was attacked in 1973. And it has been my belief and my practice every year since then to mark a moment when we reach the afternoon, when the siren sounded in the streets of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Haifa and in kibbutzim and moshavim throughout the land, sounding the alarm for young men to cast away the talit, grab their uniforms and their weapons to reach their units and defend the state of Israel at a time of its greater need. They too made a choice without even thinking, as the Arab armies that had marched on their borders made another choice. The others chose evil. They chose good. But in the Yom Kippur War, Israel lost more lives than in any other battle since the War of Independence. And so I want to ask you, on this anniversary of that day, to make a choice for good as well. And that is the choice to be bound up with the bond of Israel. I don't mean just Israel bonds. That's a way in which we can invest in Israel. That's not giving. It's assisting, but it's helping ourselves too. I ask for a different kind of a bond. I ask for a bond that retains Israel as the central spiritual center of the life of the Jewish people. My friends, in San Francisco, there was a lot of controversy this year during the film festival. There were those who said that the film festival should have restricted its agenda to films that are supportive of Israel and tell the truth, and not be a forum for propaganda of those who would side with the Palestinians. It was a time of tremendous controversy. And people on both sides were yelling of their allegiance to Israel, but wanting to express that allegiance in a different way. A mistake was indeed made, not by the choice of films, but by the choice of speakers. But the controversy served actually to raise the awareness of the state of Israel and its place in our lives more than in years prior. The same is now true with a new organization that sets itself aside from AIPAC in Washington, D.C. It's a public actions committee called J Street, founded by an Israeli American, who unfortunately uses the term in referring to us as Jewish Americans instead of American Jews. There's a lot of controversy about J Street as well. Should the United States Jews, American Jews, be united in their support of Israel? Should we be supportive of the government at all times? Should we funnel all our support through that one institution that has served the Jewish community in the state of Israel so well for so many years? Or should we also allow those who speak with a different voice to be heard? J Street, professing its allegiance to Israel, is critical of many of the government policies and its treatment of Arabs, particularly in the occupied territories of Yehuda and Shomron. The controversy has frightened many. But for me, it's an added incentive for American Jews to be involved. You see, my greatest worry is not whether people support AIPAC or J Street, whether they stand on the line of Progressive Jewish Alliance or the line of the Zionist Organization of America. It's not what films we watch and which films we argue against. My greatest concern and my biggest fear has been the growing apathy of the American Jewish community about the state of Israel. It was inconceivable a generation ago. There is no Holocaust survivor on the face of the planet that does not realize the place that Israel has in the life of the Jewish people everywhere. That Israel is not merely a country for Jews who are living in need and in fear. It's not only a haven for those who are fleeing anti-Semitism. Israel is the heart of the Jewish people. And whether we agree with the government's policies or not, we must always remember that our heart is in Jerusalem. That our soul emanates from the land of the Bible. That no matter what language we speak, no matter how comfortable we are, no matter what songs we sing, we are inevitably tied in with the land of Israel. And thank God, the state of Israel. And that's the choice I asked you to make today. I asked you to remember through the years ahead that it's our responsibility to support Israel in any way and every way we possibly can. That we have to redefine Zionism. And not say that because we don't live there, we're not Zionists. A Zionist today is an individual who realizes that the state of Israel and not New York and not Los Angeles and not Baltimore and not San Francisco is the center of the Jewish people. It is the place where our young people must go to study. It is the place where no Jew has the right to go to Paris and to Belgium, and to London before going to Israel. We are inextricably bound with the Jewish state. And we have begun to forget that. And not only does it hurt us, but it hurts our brothers and sisters in Israel. Those who survived the Holocaust and found a haven for Jews, and had their children there and their grandchildren, are realizing how distant we are. They realize that the concern is not that Jews are for or against the government's policies. Their concern is that American Jews don't seem to care that much anymore. And that's the choice that we have to make. That's a challenge on this Yom Kippur, as we remember a war that happened in 1973, when we were here in Shul, and they were on the battlefield. And we shuddered at the thought of the destruction of the Jewish state. Let's not put ourselves in a situation where we have to imagine the end of Israel before we lend it its support. That Israel continue to be the center of the Jewish people and the soul of every Jew. And then perhaps those who remember the terrible night, those who saw their sisters and brothers burned and turned into ashes, will have some comfort to know never again. not while there's a state of Israel.